Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm talking today with Robin Morantz Hennig. She's the author of 7 books, and this book that we're talking about today is Pandora's Baby, How the First Test Tube Babies Sparked the Reproductive Revolution. Welcome, Ms. Hennig.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Now, the period that you're talking about, when we first started with in vitro fertilization, we had already accomplished artificial insemination. And had that had any of the kind of controversy that you talk about here with in vitro fertilization?
It happened, but at a much lower level. I think that when people found out that artificial insemination was going on, especially with donor sperm, with sperm that didn't belong to the husband, they got a little indignant. The first time it was done was in the late 1800s, and it was actually done without the woman even knowing what was happening. This doctor just sort of snuck it in because she was not conceiving, and she didn't know why, and he figured it out without actually explaining it to her and her husband. And when it finally became revealed that that's how this baby had been conceived, it never got revealed to the woman, but they wrote it up in a medical journal. There were people who said, boy, he should have just, raped her. Would have been better than taking this stranger's sperm and inseminating her this way. That's how indignant people got about that kind of reproductive technology. But in comparison to in vitro fertilization, it was very low tech. It was kind of turkey baster insemination.
Pretty inauspicious beginning for it, though.
It was, as far as the controversy that was generated, yes.
There was a parallel case a couple years ago, right, of a doctor who was running a fertility clinic who used his own semen to sire 53 of the children that were supposed to be.
He was doing it in a high-tech way. He was doing in vitro fertilization, but people thought that the husband's sperm was being used.
Yeah,
that was pretty gruesome, in my opinion.
So, Robin, who were the first pioneers of this in vitro fertilization technique, actually putting together sperm and egg in a petri dish?
Well, there were a couple of different groups that were sort of operating at the same time, kind of a little international race. There was somebody in the United States, Landrum Shettles, who was working kind of on his own and unofficially at Columbia University. And his story is the one that I sort of focus on in the first half of my book. And the other group in England, Patrick Steptoe and Robert Edwards, were progressing in sort of a more formal way and actually more quickly, because they ended up being the ones who created the world's first test tube baby in 1978.
Were there differences in the scientific cultures that led one society to be more advanced in this than others? Or, were there particular reasons that Britons and the United States were the two pioneers in this?
Well, it wasn't the scientific culture, I don't think, so much as the political and religious culture. There was a lot of controversy in this country that came largely from anti-abortion activists. Saying that if you manipulated eggs and sperm and created embryos in a petri dish, then you were messing around with creating life. And that if you didn't implant all of the embryos that you created in this way, then you were destroying human life. So people who were already worked up about legalized abortion, which was relatively new in those days, got especially worked up in this country about the prospect of having fertility clinics do this kind of manipulation. In England, there were some of those same criticisms, but it wasn't as organized and it wasn't quite as strident as it was here. And I think that that's largely why they were allowed to proceed at a faster pace than we were.
And would you attribute that, as some do, to the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court Roe v. Wade decision kind of shocked the American society in a way that the more gradual political legalization of abortion in Europe and Britain didn't shock those publics into that kind of mobilization?
Yeah, it could be something like that, that the people who were opposed to abortion got sort of catalyzed by Roe v. Wade in 1973, and so then the 70s was a time when people were very frightened of alienating that group that was becoming more and more organized. One of the results of it was that not only that we were slower than Great Britain in establishing IVF clinics, but also that the federal government refused to pay any research money to actually investigating how to do in vitro fertilization, so that all the improvements that were done, all the research that was conducted, were done with private funding, which kind of left things open a little bit to the entrepreneurs and, you know, in some cases, the sort of rogues and cowboys to do their science the way the market allowed them to, rather than to follow some of the restrictions that come along with getting a federal research grant.
That theme has carried through all the way to the beginning, all the way to the present, because people in the various presidential bioethics bodies have pointed out this inconsistency. Here we have this massive medicalization of reproductive technology, and we don't have any regulatory oversight over it.
That's right. And this is something that sort of has characterized this particular field from the very beginning. There have been, in fact, some of the first bioethics commissions were established specifically to address this question of whether it would be ethically acceptable for the government to pay for research involving human fetuses and embryos. And at every step of the way, it seems, the bioethics commissions ended up coming up with a report that said, yes, under certain conditions, this could be ethically acceptable. And the politicians didn't usually like those reports, so they kind of ignored what the commission had said and waited for a little while and then set up a new commission hoping that it would say something different. And consistently, this is the pattern that's happened. You know, the commissions get set up, they do their deliberations, they decide that under certain conditions this research can go on, and the government ignores it and waits and sets up another commission.
Well, actually, between the Carter Commission and the Clinton bioethics commissions, it was impossible for Republicans to appoint presidential bioethics commissions at all because of right-to-life politics.
That's right. Right. In fact, they tried to create one, and it just all bogged down altogether in who was getting appointed.
Now, a name that comes up very often in this discussion and comes up in your book about the response to IVF is Leon Cass. And where did Leon Cass come from, and what was his response to this new technology?
He began as a biologist at the University of Chicago, but he got very interested in the late 60s, early 70s in bioethics, which is, you know, a bigger topic, sort of mixes biology and philosophy and law, a little bit of everything. And he was very opposed to in vitro fertilization. In his view, allowing this kind of manipulation of reproduction would threaten, basically, civilization as we know it. You know, he was very worried about its impact on the nuclear family, on our sense of, you know, who we are and where we're going and what our relationship to our parents and children are. And, you know, he saw very big threats to the human condition. He stayed active in opposing a lot of developments in reproductive technology, so much so that when President Bush in 2001 named a bioethics commission again, this time to consider whether embryonic stem cell research should go on, he asked Leon Cass to head the council. So Cass has been an opponent for the last 30 years of this kind of development, and is still out there now criticizing things like reproductive cloning, therapeutic cloning, embryonic stem cell research, using in many cases much the same vocabulary that he used in the 70s criticizing IVF.
In fact, the latest report from the President's Bioethics Commission is on ethics at the beginning of life, and he just fired the two ethicists on the commission who most vocally disagreed with him about that.
Well, Cass didn't fire them. Bush fired them. But yes, the ones who were the most, this is a new method of ignoring what the commissions say, not only just disbanding it and waiting to start a new one, but actually playing around with the roster of a standing commission.
So how big an impact, I've been thinking about this also in light of the gay marriage debate, because you have these moral panics. And if you go back to the before World War I, when there was moral panics about the interracial marriage and interracial relations, there were proposals for constitutional amendments to ban interracial marriage, just as there is today. And then you had people begin to have interracial relationships. And at some point, there's a tipping point where you know, there's enough evidence that that civilization is not collapsing, that things change. And
what
was the tipping point, the birth of Louise Brown? Did everything become normalized after
that?
Well,
I think that made a big difference when she turned out to be normal, because there was a real fear that she would be a monster, you know, and it wasn't just the Cassandras of the world, just the people like Leon Cass who thought it would undo the fabric of society. There were scientists who thought that it could be a good idea, but that the manipulations would be damaging to the chromosomes. So once Louise Brown was born, a lot of those concerns disappeared. But I don't think that she was the single thing that changed. I think that it was a slow accrual of experience where babies kept getting born and kept being okay, and parents kept loving them, and it kept being no big deal for the kids to even find out how they had been conceived. You know, it was a lot of small increments that happened in a pattern so that we hardly even noticed that things had changed. I don't think that in this case there was something like a tipping point, you know, a single moment in time. I think it's that we just got used to it without even really paying attention. You know, some of the critics of IVF early on said they predicted something a little bit like this, but they had it in much more ominous terms. They were calling it a slippery slope, you know, that if we took this first step in this direction of intervening in reproduction, then even if that first step was okay, it was the first step on a slippery slope towards much more terrible applications. And I don't like the slippery slope argument because it's a regressive one. It's something that doesn't allow us to try new things. But in a way, there is a slope of sorts. You know, if you do find yourself taking one step and things are okay, you take the next step and don't worry about it quite as much.
You've mentioned that the techniques were shown to be safe, but as you go on to show in the book, the more recent evidence shows that there are some risks to the children in terms of birth defects.
Right, there are some risks. And in fact, it took longer to have those show up than it could have if this were something that the government had funded in an organized way, because the long-term studies were done kind of on a voluntary basis. For a long time, they thought that if there was an increase in birth defects in IVF children, it was probably because there was also an increase in the number of twins and triplets that were born after IVF, because most clinics put back several embryos, hoping that at least one of them will take into a pregnancy, and sometimes two or three of them take. And there's always more of a risk of birth defects and low birth weight and premature birth when you're giving birth to multiples. But recently, there have been more careful studies that have you know, sort of controlled for the increase in multiple births, and have seen that there are some birth defects, some of them serious, but most of them relatively minor, that are somewhat more likely in babies born after a variety of reproductive technology methods. Not only IVF, you know, sort of straight IVF, but also some of the more sort of high-tech versions of IVF that have developed in the last 10 years or so.
I'm speaking with Robin Morantz-Hennig. She's the author of Pandora's Baby, How the First Test Tube Baby Sparked the Reproductive Revolution. I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. There's also been some studies recently of the psychological impact of artificial reproductive technology, and those have been pretty uniformly positive, that kids born with children of choice, as some people call them, are uniformly as loved or better loved than the kids who are children of chance.
Right. The first American test tube baby, Elizabeth Carr, who's in her early 20s now and talks about this a lot, I met her and interviewed her for the book, and she said that, you know, for a while people would say when they found out how she was conceived, oh, that's disgusting. And she would say, this is when she was like 7, well, it's not as gross as the way you were conceived. So really, I think that there's just sort of a bigger acceptance of all the varieties of family building than people could have anticipated, you know, and this is one variation of that. There are so many ways in which the traditional nuclear family has been monkeyed around with a little bit without too much damage to anybody, that this is just one of those variations.
And this is where artificial reproductive technology really is connected quite closely to the gay marriage debate. It's about our changing conceptions of families and how what's normal about being a family.
That's right. And you know, there is a place in gay family building for reproductive technologies. I mean, if a homosexual male couple or a lesbian couple wants to create a child, somewhere along the way, a doctor is usually going to have to get involved.
So now the Leon Cass and Francis Fukuyama and some of these conservatives have come around to say, well, okay, let's get involved in this, but they would like us to establish what Britain's established, the human reproductive something.
Yeah, HFEA, Human Fetus and Embryology Authority, something like that.
Authority. Yeah. Because it has this broad mandate to tell people, parents, what they can and can't do. Whereas if this gets governed under the FDA, which just has the mandate to tell whether it's safe or not, mm-hmm. it would be a much more restrictive mandate and would leave it pretty much still in parents'
yeah.
hands.
Well, I hate to actually align myself with Leon Cass and Francis Fukuyama, but I can understand that as being a decent model. On the other hand, I mean, what's nice about the British agency is that things are sort of out there in the open, and when something comes up, it's considered. You know, people bring to it some situations that could be ethically complicated. Sometimes, though, they do make sort of blanket pronouncements. Recently, they decided that it was not acceptable to screen embryos before reimplanting them after IVF. Solely for the basis of sex selection. And I can understand their nervousness about doing such a thing, but to totally ban something like that, I think, could be a problem somewhere along the line when you come up with perfectly legitimate reasons why that could be an okay use for that kind of technology. You know, having any kind of organization that makes blanket pronouncements like that can lead you to some trouble.
Well, why couldn't we do that with the FDA? I mean, the FDA seems to have no problem regulating lots of other kinds of medical tests and procedures.
Well, the FDA doesn't have control over how something is used once it's on the market. You know, that's been their problem with a lot of medications, you know, with off-label use of medications. Once something is approved because it's safe for whatever condition the drug company says that you can use it for, doctors are free to use it for anything they want. So the FDA really isn't set up as an agency to have much say in medical practice. They're just a way to evaluate what drugs and devices come on the market in the first place. There could be some other agency, I guess, that would be able to make those kind of pronouncements. But in this administration in particular, the decision-making process of science has become so politicized that this just strikes me as not the best time to try to set up something like that. Because you really have to have it be... there's really two tracks that these things have to occur on. There's the scientific track of, you know, what is scientifically possible and what direction should we move in there. And then there's the social track of once we understand how you can do something, how do we apply it? And I'm not quite sure what mechanisms we've got right now to sort of bring those two tracks together.
Some of the issues that are coming up are things like human enhancement medicine and so forth, and cloning, of course. You draw out some of the parallels to the current cloning debate. And do you think that, but the big difference in my mind is that with cloning, there is such substantial evidence that it's still an unsafe technique to create children, that they would have gross genetic abnormalities. And even though there was this unknown, slightly higher risk of IVF, it was demonstrably a pretty safe technique. So it's not exactly parallel, but you think that the moral panic is parallel.
Well, I love your phrase, moral panic. I had never heard that before, and I think that is sort of... what it is that's going on. The moral panic is a little bit different with cloning because, or else it may be a little bit more justifiable, because with IVF, the only thing that was changing was the locus, the place where the fertilization took place. Usually it occurs in a woman's fallopian tube, and here it was occurring in a petri dish, but the embryo was going back into the womb and growing in a normal pregnancy. With cloning, a lot of that is the case with cloning, actually, too. You know, the embryo starts growing in the petri dish and gets put into somebody's uterus. But the entire process of reproduction is mucked around with. You know, reproduction means mixing two people's genetic components, you know, mixing half from the father and half from the mother. And with cloning, you skip that part altogether. And that part exists for a whole lot of good evolutionary reasons. You know, being able to mix two people's genes allows for improvements in the human species. And you, if cloning became a common method of reproduction, we would interfere with that.
Yeah, but aren't we past the point where we really need to rely on this mechanism for improvement in the genome? I mean, we're going to have very quickly genetic enhancement through various kinds of vectors and selection effects that will supersede all that.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I guess that, you know, if you're presuming that we're going to be able to fix the genome in whatever way we want to, then who needs to have the random mixing up of genes? I guess the answer would be that then cloning wouldn't be as big a deal. But part of the problem is, even if we got wise enough to, you know, scientifically, technically wise enough to know how to do these genetic interventions to improve what we think is, you know, flaws in the genome, we could be wrong about the things that we want to improve. You know, people were first talking about cloning like back in the 60s and 70s, and they were writing articles that would say things like, well, who would you clone? Raquel Welch? The Shah of Iran? I mean, if you think about that, if that's who ended up getting cloned and getting sort of enshrined as the ideal human specimen, just because that was somebody's ideal at the time, you know, that wouldn't be such a good idea. So thinking that we can totally subvert any of the wisdom of evolution, which is kind of a stupid kind of wisdom, you know, is just a sort of random trying different combinations and seeing what works. The idea that we can replace that with some sort of a directed human plan, I think is possibly more arrogant than we should risk.
Perhaps, but I guess what for me it often comes back to is, and one of the reasons I prefer an FDA kind of minimalist regulatory scheme to the FEA type scheme, mm-hmm. is that John Robertson is a bioethicist who's written Children of Choice, and his exploration of the bioethics of artificial reproduction, and he argues for what he calls procreative liberty. Now, many feminists have not adopted or are critical of this idea that the right to use artificial reproductive technology should be included in our general reproductive rights. But it seems to me obvious that if you have a right to, for instance, abortion and contraception as a part of your right to control your own body, then why wouldn't you also have a right to use, to control your own genome and to use artificial reproductive technology?
Mm-hmm. I personally agree with you, but people's argument against it is that you're not controlling your genome, you're controlling your child's genome. So that the person who you could consider the patient or the research subject is not you, and is somebody who can't give any kind of informed consent. I mean, that's one argument that's been used against it.
Sure, but you could use, now that there's evidence that IVF actually increases the risks of, marginally, but it still increases the risks of a birth defect,
mm-hmm.
Parents still, I believe, would argue that that's their decision to make, and
right.
their decision about when and how to have children includes a decision about what kinds of risks they should be able to take in terms of birth defects and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
You're right, and many of the choices that we're facing now have analogies in choices that we have faced in the past, and that's why I enjoyed researching and writing the book, because hearing some of the arguments that seem so modern now, hearing them 30 years ago applied to something that in retrospect seems relatively innocent, sort of makes you rethink the reasons why people object to certain changes in the way things are done.
Well, I really want to recommend your book. It's called Pandora's Baby, How the First Test Tube Babies Sparked the Reproductive Revolution. It's by Robin Morantz Hennig, a very accomplished scientific historian, a writer of a number of very well critically acclaimed books. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Our nation is struggling to defend a traditional biblical understanding of marriage, so I'd like to offer this constitutional amendment to defend biblical marriage in the United States. Marriage in the United States shall consist of a union between one man and one or more women. Genesis 29:17-28. Marriage shall not impede a man's right to take concubines in addition to his wife or wives. Samuel 5:13, 1 Kings 11:3, and 2 Chronicles 11:21. A marriage shall be considered valid only if the wife is a virgin. If the wife is not a virgin, she shall be executed. Deuteronomy 22:13-21. Marriage of a believer and an unbeliever shall be forbidden. Genesis 24:3. Since marriage is for life, neither this Constitution nor the Constitution of any state, nor any state or federal law, shall be construed to permit divorce. Deuteronomy 22:19. If a married man dies without children, his brother shall marry the widow. If he refuses to marry his brother's widow or deliberately does not give her children, he shall pay a fine of 1 shoe and be otherwise punished in a manner to be determined by law. Genesis 38:6-10. On the basis of these biblical principles, I'm sure we can reestablish the sanctity of the American family. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.